Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and Martin, quickly, is this election ever going to end?
Yeah, it will end, Tony, and then we'll have another one immediately afterwards.
I won't survive another one. When I was dropping you into hospital and I was convinced that this was the end for you. What did you tell me when I literally got you to the door of the cancer ward? What did you say?
I'll see you into the grave.
And I think you might actually do it at this stage. I got to keel over before you do, and you'll just go, I fucking told you so.
No. The numbers aren't working. The allegiances aren't working for the big two in the way they have in the past. I thought Saoirse McHugh was very impressive last night. Called it it's nice to have that honesty in politics. And all we're seeing at the moment, Tony, is this incredible dishonesty in politics.
Well, the numbers are there. Housekeeping. Yesterday we went with Reboot Republic podcast. We went to the Irish Wheelchair Association and we recorded a podcast with two wonderful ladies about the fact that disabilities aren't featuring in this election campaign. Go and check it out. It was great to go there. It was great to get their voices. When you hear about housing, we don't hear about housing for people with disabilities. When we hear about employment opportunity, we don't hear about that for people with disabilities. We need to talk about that in a broader sense. And then secondly, it has to be said, guys, we do need support. I appreciate people coming on board. But we won't be at this for much longer.
Show us the money.
Look, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We really appreciate every cent we get. But keep it on board. Back into the fact that, Martin, you're saying about dishonesty. I'm gonna go straight into something that's been annoying me. And you know I've been talking about this for about a year on social media. The CIO of Independent News and Media is a good friend, a very good friend of the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar's. He was already appointed when Leo was the Minister for Transport to a job in CIE, Dublin Bus. And there was already things were said to say that it was inappropriate at the time. Now, nothing came of it, but nonetheless, this is the second appointment that this gentleman has got. He's a friend and a local neighbour of the Taoiseach's. And then yesterday I see him out canvassing with the Taoiseach. And I'm thinking, he's there in the largest newspaper group in the country. He's openly campaigning for Fine Gael. And we have to put up with this where the media are just attacking and undermining everything that the left stand for, particularly Sinn Féin, and we're supposed to believe that we have a free press. Now, I want to believe that we have a free press, but I have to also say that there are bad faith players, and these people who are engaging in this are bad faith players. And by not disclosing these things, by not actually saying that I have political allegiances, that is just wrong. Okay, we're supposed to have these things. I have to do a fitness and probity thing every year in my role and to declare my allegiances and all of these things. People come at us and say, well, you guys are biased. Absolutely, we're biased.
Yeah, straight out their balls up.
Own our biases. But this is this is the largest newspaper group in the country. And you cannot tell me that does not have an influence on what the content of the output of those newspapers are.
I agree with you, Tony. We have... People are moving away from print media, and they're moving away from it for a reason. Trust is a big thing with print media, and it is, who do you trust? Newspapers in Ireland have historically favoured one political party over another political party. It's never been a balanced view.
I don't really care about the people keep saying we're not as bad as the UK. But at least in the UK, they bluntly put it on the front page.
We're a Tory newspaper.
Yeah, this nonsense of saying we're not, and then actually having it written into the what we call coercive control, or what we call silent self-censorship, where you write to a certain way and you pull your punches because you think that this is where you have to earn a wage. And those things are very serious issues. And I'm leveling that charge at certain individuals in INM. Well, they can tell me what. Tell me I'm wrong, and I'd be delighted to be proven wrong.
Let me just explain it from my point of view. We've interviewed loads of people in here from different parties, and you get to like and know the people that you interview. But then when it comes to the time where you have to not pull your punch, it takes a conscious effort, and I have noticed this a lot. It really takes a conscious effort not to pull punches. Not to pull punches. And I have to say to myself, yes, I know this person. Yes, I know this about this person. I know this is a decent person, but this is the situation. And I don't colour it. I just throw it out there. And I think when you're very close, and I mean very close to people, that's more difficult. And I think that is a problem.
Yeah, well, that being said, campaign, back onto the campaign trail. We've seen the debacle around the comments by Catherine Noone. We've seen the Taoiseach accept her apology. We've seen people who have, or are family members of people who have autism, saying, well, it's not really... It's not just for him to say sorry. To him, she has to say sorry to these people because it was used in that as a pejorative term. What I will say is that moving forward, I think quietly Fine Gael realise the game is up. That it's all that they're now campaigning to see where they're going to be in opposition or the third place in this. I genuinely do feel that, and I've seen that. I do think it's absolutely wrong that this was said about the Taoiseach, by the way, on a personal level. You know, you can attack him for his policies, you can attack him for all of these other reasons. To do that was just pathetic. And I would expect better from your... If your own friends were going around your back saying things like that as a slur, it's just outrageous.
Okay, and I said this to you yesterday, and this is very strange from me. But if I was Leo Varadkar, that would upset me. That would upset me if I would be upset that people would be thinking that way or even talking that way behind my back. I would think, well, geez, you know, people throw shit in some sticks, and you'll be thinking to yourself, God, am I really that way? So, yeah, I do have a lot of empathy for him in that position. It's not an easy thing to deal with.
Back on the campaign trail, Sinn Féin launched their manifesto. Found it quite funny that I've seen a lot of commentary saying that, you know, where are they going to get the money for that? And I know that Sinn Féin handed their manifesto into the Department of Finance to cost it and it's handed back to them. So the money was actually agreed with our own Department of Finance that it's there. I also saw a comment, several comments about, you know, the housing policy. You pick any, and I say this as someone who bias again, own my bias, I think Eoin O'Brien would be the best housing minister of all of them. But also I say the challenge would be ask any political party's leader, would they swap their housing spokesperson for Eoin O'Brien in the morning? Every one of them would.
Now, Micheál Martin was asked that this morning. And yeah. He was asked that on Sean O'Rourke this morning, and he obfuscated. But, you know, there is no shining light in Fianna Fáil for housing. I mean, there is nobody you can look at in Fianna Fáil and go, that's a natural housing minister.
Well, I know Dara O'Brien is their spokesperson. He's been kind enough to come in here, and we've disagreed on a number of things. I'm not saying that Dara O'Brien is not... I can't judge a guy who hasn't done the job, but I'm simply saying, on the balance of things, if you put them up and said to the leaders of the parties, and said... like a draft, you know, you get to select this person.
Yeah, your rainbow coalition.
They'd have all jumped and grabbed Eoin O'Brien at this stage. Yeah. So it's really disingenuous of a lot of commentators, pundits, some political correspondents who should know better to say that the housing policy is something that they could take a shot at. Come back, Labour actually are very interesting, have said that they want a 3-year rent freeze, not a 2-year rent freeze. That's actually pretty cool, like, because we're hearing nothing for renters. You got to give them credit. At least it's something, Martin.
Yeah.
Hang on.
No, I'm not denying, Tony. It is. And I think, yeah, let's raise that bar. 3 years is good. But I don't think a rent freeze is the ultimate solution. I think there's no point in a rent freeze if you don't have a campaign of building that's going to put enough units up.
Labour want to build 100,000 homes. All of these things, like Sinn Féin want to build, Labour want to build 80,000, Sinn Féin want to build 100,000. This is doable. This is achievable over a good term. Like, if you give yourself enough years to do it.
Oh, well, I remember when we had O'Coolan, when we had
Hugh Brennan
on stage, and Lorcan Sir said, look, the way you do this is you bring in Hugh Brennan, you hand him the state-owned land, and you say, Hugh, how do you scale this up? And I was talking to Orla Hegarty then afterwards, and Orla said, look, it can't all be public. You're going to have to sell some to fund the rest. But she reckoned 12 months you have units. You have units. And if you scale it up enough, You know, you're talking about solving this in a 5-year period.
I want to come in on one thing on that, because the government will tell you, Fine Gael will tell you that the LDA, the Land Development Agency, was their answer to this, and they were going to take public land, they were going to hand it to developers, and they were going to get some of the units back at the end of it, and there was going to be a mix there, you know, mostly private, you know, it ramped up part 5 or whatever it is. Yeah. But what was funny about that is the LDA was created because of the obsession in Fine Gael of the market and then to keep things off balance sheet.
Yeah.
But the LDA, because they're effectively an independent company, can't compel the state to hand their public lands to them. And if they get the powers of compellability, straight away Eurostat say, well, then you're a state body and therefore all your finance goes on balance sheet and it defeats the entire purpose of it. So, you know, their solution was all tied up on the basis that you want local authorities to say, yeah, we'll just give you our land because you asked us for it.
Yeah.
Which is just an absolutely ridiculous thing. And no one talks about it enough. They go, the LDA as a concept, all fine and dandy, but the idea then, let's say that it's underwritten by keep it off balance sheet and that will work, it won't work like that, because you can't just turn around and say, imagine if I went up and said, there's a site down the road, I'd like it, please.
Yeah.
Would you just give it to me, Martin?
No.
No. So you'd want something in return, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And if I wanted something in return, I have to get money to give to you. I have to go down that road. Boom, balance sheet, folks. So if you want to talk about building public and affordable and social and a mix of private on public land, it can be doable, but you can't do it in that model of just saying, listen, I've sent your man a letter and said, I hope he gives me the site.
Well, it's funny you say that. I've a friend, an accountant in Colombia, probably one of the most dangerous jobs in Colombia. But anyway, he rang me the other evening and he goes, why don't they just build houses? He said, is it down to the bad credit rate? And I said, we have a AAA credit rate. And he goes, what? I went, yeah, they got the AAA credit rating back a few years ago. And he goes, and they still haven't built houses. And I went, yeah.
And we can borrow cheaper than...
Of course, you can actually borrow at negative interest rates at the moment.
Where is this going in the next couple of days?
Don't know. I think it has stagnated. I think the 7-way debate, whilst interesting... I don't think it's going to change any trends that are happening, any of that wave, those three polls that have come in. I'm sure we'll have a poll or two at the weekend. Be interesting to see where those polls go. My feeling is that Fine Gael are still going to lose ground. Fianna Fáil are going to lose ground, just slower. Mm. I think the left bloc will have fortified itself, whether it actually gains any or not. Yeah, a percent or two, I reckon. And I reckon that's the trend all the way to the end, bar... people stick their foot in it. But yeah, it's very interesting
events.
That Fine Gael have taken an approach of sacrificing a person a day to keep the herd. Yeah, that's very good.
It looks like I have a feeling there's going to be, you know, there's going to be more catastrophes. There's going to be more people making mistakes, and there's going to be more, unfortunately, events that are going to overtake what is actually happening on the campaign trail. And I think they're all going to be, actually, the majority of those will go against the government. That's just, they're in charge, the events will happen, it will be blamed on them.
We're in this whole black and tan situation, Tony, where no matter what they do now, it's the wrong move.
But what I will say is that I've heard rumblings from people in PPP, people in the Greens, people in Sinn Féin, about talking now.
Yeah.
Already.
Yeah, yeah.
Very positive. We've been calling
for it. Hugely positive. Hugely positive that the left would sit down with each other just even before the election would be ideal. And then immediately after the election, regardless of what the result is, let's show people that there is an alternative.
Yeah. We have two interviews today, one with the Social Democrats candidate Angus O'Mwelon, who's a friend of the pod as well, long time listener, first time caller. And we have the Greens' Patrick Costello coming on as well.
And just a little nod to the Social Democrats, doing very well in Galway. That's looking very promising.
Our interview with Niall O'Toole is one of our earlier general election ones. And you know what, Niall, best luck
to
you.
Yeah, well
mate.
Done, buddy.
Talk to you all soon. Stay tuned for these interviews. Thank you. We're delighted to be joined on the line by the Social Democrats candidate for Dublin West, Aengus O'Mahlon. Aengus, how are you, buddy?
Very well, Tommy. Thank you very much.
Listen, you're in a tough constituency there. Why?
You can say that again.
Yeah. No, you really are. You're in the Taoiseach's constituency, in fact, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in the Taoiseach's constituency. I'm a former Taoiseach there. I reckon all four sitting TDs are household names. There's two or three other very strong candidates as well. What I've been saying is it's kind of like a Champions League group with Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Liverpool and Bohemians in it. And guess who's Bohemians?
Yeah, but I just have to say, being a
I suppose what I'm hoping people will do is understand that, yes, it's a very tough group, but at the same time, the seats belong to the people. And we get to choose the people who represent us in Leinster House, and that goes for Dublin 15 and Dublin 7, no matter who's currently sitting in those seats, regardless.
Can I ask you, though, so why did you decide to throw your hat in the ring? Why? What are you running for?
Well, I suppose personally, my story is a very familiar story to a lot of people. I got out of college in 2011, just as the recession had turned into a depression. There was no work going for me. I had to move home to my mother, as a lot of people did. And so I did what most people did, I think, at that age, and I emigrated. I spent 4 years in Norway, where I saw how social democracy works in practice. Worked hard, saved, met the woman who's now my wife. We came back a couple of years ago, and my commitment was essentially looking back at that period between 2008 and 2011 and seeing how essentially government policy at the time was. The problem here is not unemployment, it's that we have too many young people unemployed. So we're going to make it as easy as possible for them to emigrate and not be clogging up the system. And my commitment essentially is to make sure that that never happens again, that we never have that lazy and just self-defeating sort of economics in this country. So that's why I'm running. And the fact that we're now in a situation where the economy is growing again, but we still have over 10,000 people homeless, 4,000 of them children. We have becoming normal that people are accepting that there's violence and gangland crime in the streets where it's normal to expect to spend 3 days on a hospital trolley. It seems like we've learned nothing from the last 20 years in Ireland at all.
Can you tell me how you're going to achieve it, Aengus, particularly in relation to immigration? Because immigration has always been
emigration
has always been the safety valve for non-performing governments.
Well, it has, absolutely. But it comes down to a historic disrespect for young people in the country. And by young, I mean anyone under 40. Like, we're not talking about teenagers here, where they've been expected to work hard when the jobs are there, pay taxes, pay over the shoulder for over the odds for childcare, pay rent, pay mortgages when they're available, and getting absolutely nothing back. And so when the economy takes a hit, as you say, we're treated as a safety valve, and it's just easier for the government to deport or export 300 of us. 300,000 of us. And wasn't it Charles Haughey who in the 90s said that never again will our young people be exported like cattle?
Yeah.
But it's happened at least twice since then.
Mm. It has, and it continues to happen, not on the same scale, but, you know, as soon as a downturn comes, then it's the same thing again, and it affects every single family in Ireland. Can I ask you, coalition, what would be your preferred coalition, and are you prepared to go into a broad left coalition?
Well, on the broad left question, absolutely. That would be my preference. But as my party leader, Roisin Shorthall, said, it's not up to us who else gets elected. I'm only running for my own seat. And what will be up to us if I am elected is to look at who else has been elected. And the job then is to work with whoever's there. So we, unusually among the parties, haven't ruled anyone out. We haven't ruled anyone in either. And we're open to discussing coalition when we get past the election, we see what the numbers are. Because ultimately, our party has always prided ourselves on having evidence-based, reasonable policies to fix the crises that are gripping the country now. And if we can get our policies through, and also, as I say, have a government which is addressing the real needs of people in Ireland, then I see no reason why we should rule anyone out.
Is it possible that even before the election, that the broader left would meet up and talk to each other?
Well, I'd say pragmatically, it's unlikely that we'll meet up before the election, because I think everyone is working absolutely crazy hours, knocking on doors and talking to people. But I would very much like to see the broad left working together. And I think it's the only way we're going to end the historical domination of two large centre-right Christian Democratic parties, is if we start to cooperate more closely.
I think it's just in terms of, you know, I suppose in terms of your own politics, you've explained it there. Is there a particular thing, policy or policy message that you'd like to put across?
Well, my whole political outlook as a social democrat, both capital S, capital D, and small s, small d, is that I believe we should be measuring our success as a country based on how the least well-off are doing, not just on how the best well-off are doing. And we've seen in the various leaders' debates people talking about, you know, average wages approaching 50,000 and all of that, but that's simply not the lived reality of people. What we need to do is have a real attempt at a social democracy in this country where we support people and we don't expect them to cope with or tolerate underfunded, underperforming public services.
I think that's a very fair point. What we do suffer extremely in this country from this mentality that, look, you know, I saw you actually made a good point yourself on social media tonight about this average wage being quoted at us when it's not the actual median wage.
Average wage is a skewed statistic, because we have a huge wage inequality in Ireland. We're very, actually a very unequal country, even statistically. The OECD even acknowledges that, that the average wage of 47,000 is only true for full-time employees. And also average for wages is a problematic statistic, because what you do is you take all of the wages that everyone earns and divide it by the number of people, which means that people who earn a huge amount are being counted in that statistic, as well as people, most people who earn much less than that. So the median wage, which is a statistic I think is much more helpful, is considerably below 30,000.
Yeah, well, I think that's the one thing that we try to do in this podcast all the time, is break through those statistics that are generally, you know, they're weighted in favour of the people, the sitting power, to put forward these arguments. And I know it bothers Martin greatly, where you turn around and say, there must be a lot of people sitting around the dinner table saying, why aren't I on 47? I thought I was average, you know.
Well, exactly. And it's also, it excludes anyone who works part-time. It excludes people who can't work full-time because either they can't afford childcare for their kids, so they need to come home at a certain time. It excludes people who may have a family member who requires care and they can't afford a caregiver. It excludes people who may be qualifying for family income set subsidies and all of that as well. So I think it's not only disingenuous, but also very disrespectful, I think, to use that figure as saying, sure, aren't we doing great? We're all on 47,000. Well, that is simply not true.
Well, I suppose my last thing now, Angus, is just Dublin West. Any messages for the constituents?
Well, I mean, the main message is that this is not as good as it gets. We can do much better. Social Democrats believe that we can be reaching towards what is normal in the rest of Europe. We can have a health service that you can rely on, so you don't have to have private health insurance. You can have a truly free education system. You can have enough police on the streets so that you can feel safe in your homes and on the streets. And we believe all of that is possible. And it's not rocket science. It's been done in almost every other country in Europe already.
Thanks for coming on and having a chat with us, Angus. We wish you the very best in your election, and we hope to see you afterwards.
Thanks, lad.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Dublin City Councillor and social worker and Green Party spokesperson for transport and general election candidate for Dublin South Central, Patrick Costlow. Patrick, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. Listen, first and foremost, it was a good night the other night, actually. I really enjoyed it at the live show. So it was lovely to meet you and your good lady wife. But I suppose what I didn't get to ask you there and then is, why are you running? What are you thinking?
Well, for me, look, I'm running because I want to affect change, because I want to try and make things better. I worked in homeless services for years. I'm now a child protection social worker, you know, and you can work yourself to the bone for 10 families, trying to make things better for like 10 families. But the reality is, if you can get in and you can change the power structures, you can change the rules of the game, you can make things better for 10,000 families. You know, and it's there are lots of issues that are really societal level issues that the families I deal with are facing. And they're the kind of things I'm not going to be able to change by myself in the middle of a case as a social worker. Mm. But if you can get into place, if you can get into politics and engage with it at that level, you can make things better for everyone.
I think that's a fairly comprehensive answer for listeners out there. Do you mind me asking though, in terms of the ambitions for when you get in, what would be your main ambitions? Give me two or three of them.
Well, I think for me, the main ambitions would be facing up to the reality of climate change and the challenge it faces in front of us, but also investing in housing, investing in transport, and investing in communities. And I think particularly with the last three, if you do them right, we can help address the climate change problem that's coming down the tracks towards us.
I just want to come in on that one, because the other night you made a great point about the housing when we were talking, obviously, in the company of Owen O'Brien, who for my money is possibly the best housing spokesperson there was. But you made a really good point that in front of the live audience about the link between housing and climate. Do you want to elaborate on that for me?
Yeah, well, there's kind of two aspects to it. If you're building the right houses in the right place, you're going to address climate change. So there's so many people I meet while canvassing whose sons and daughters are looking to buy and have had to move to Athlone or Dundalk and are still commuting into Dublin. And that's, you know, that's adding huge amounts of carbon to their commute. Mm. And it's also adding huge time to their commute. And that's going to affect their health, their mental health, their physical health, their family life, you know. And as I say, if they're driving, they're churning out the pollution, the car fumes, the CO2. So if you can build affordable houses or houses that are achievable and attainable within Dublin for people who want to live and work in Dublin, you're instantly cutting all of that out. The second thing is about building the right kind of houses. So you need to look at energy standards of houses. You need to look at modern technology like near zero energy buildings or passive housing.
Yeah.
So there was an example I gave on the night of Exeter. Exeter Council were building public housing and they were under a Tory government. So the Tories weren't going to give them any extra money for trying to build energy efficient buildings. But they engaged with builders and they were able to deliver passive house standard homes for one particular project. And the thing is, with a passive house standard home, they're incredibly cheap to run and to heat. So instantly, anyone who moved into these homes had a house that was warm, that was cozy, and that was cheap. So it eradicated the issues around fuel poverty. And it meant that these people could live safely for very little money and warmly for very little money. And the council noticed that there was a knock-on effect that this estate had significantly lower rent arrears than every other estate they were dealing with. Because, you know, their tenants had money in their pocket.
They weren't forcing it out
for rent. Now, the thing is, there's issues, you know, there are filters and things you need to replace. But the council were doing that and they said it was still cheaper to do that than to replace boilers and to worry about that kind of stuff. And particularly with all the money coming in now that they'd eradicated rent arrears and fuel poverty, it was not a problem. And the thing is, for us, you know, the Greens tried to introduce a requirement for passive house standard in the city development plan in the last council session. And we were told, no, you can't do this. It has to come from the national building standards. So again, it's kind of an example that, you know, it's actually ultimately the department and this government that are getting in the way, not only of building houses, but building the right houses and in the right place.
Listen, mate, I'm glad you got that out, because as I said, I was impressed by that on the night, and I'm glad we got to talk to, and hopefully the listeners will pick up on that, because these things are, the struggle for housing is the struggle for climate change action as well. And that is true. Can I ask, post-election, you know, we're seeing these polls come in and we feel the momentum, and people are genuinely, you know, optimistic now. We're feeling the hope. Do you believe that there's an opportunity there for a broad left coalition, and should we all talk to each other post-election?
We should all be talking to each other post-election. We really should be. But the reality is we have challenges to face up to, and we need to make sure that we're talking to people who are taking them seriously. Housing is one of them. Are the people we're talking to going to take housing seriously and the need for the government to start building again for public housing? Are who the people we're talking to going to take the climate emergency seriously, the biodiversity crisis seriously? And as I say, these things aren't mutually exclusive. But really, we need, you know, if we don't address housing, that is a horrendous moral failing and it is a human rights issue.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't address climate change, first of all, there'll be massive fines coming from the European Union, which will make it even harder to address the housing issue. But also, like, there's a real existential threat there. So, you know, I will talk to anyone as long as they're going to be serious about those issues and addressing those issues.
I suppose that's pretty, like, I see, I keep hearing people going, you know, these are our green lines and these are our green red lines. but I think that's pretty fair because it is a housing election. There's no two ways about it. Climate is definitely to the forefront, but I also think once you can show that they're interlinked, it's a really healthy thing to have for a democracy to show that this thing can happen. Do you mind me, look, you're in a tough bailiwick, mate. You're in a tough area there. Have you got a message for your constituents?
Well, look, I would ask them for their number one vote. You know, I think that the Green Party have realistic solutions around climate change, that as well as, like as we've spoken about the housing, as well as addressing this serious threat, can actually make life better. We want to invest in public housing. We want to invest in public transport. We want to invest in communities and community development. And really, I think that, you know, we're a party that is taking all of these issues really, really seriously. And, you know, while some parties might be good on one or two of them, I think we're the only ones really taking all of them seriously. And I would ask for their number one to show that they too are serious around climate and housing and transport and community.
Patrick Costello, Green Party candidate in Dublin South Central. All the best in the upcoming general election. Thank you so much for taking the call.
Lovely. Listen, thanks very much. Not a problem.